You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, March 18th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, to go over Friday's blockbuster Senate hearing, Senate Banking Subcommittee hearing, wherein testimony was taken from J.P. Morgan executives on their whale fail deal. Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone will be here to tell us of the many faceted aspects of this. I don't know if it's an 100% criminal enterprise, but is any enterprise really 100% criminal? I mean, even when you go to rob a bank, presumably the bank robbers, you know, maintain the speed limit on the way to the bank. Oh. Yeah, you might want to plug in your microphone before you talk. Well, a highly technically proficient crew here. Also on the program today, Cyprus. Still unclear whether or not they're going to basically create a bank run as policy. The NRA, responsible for maintaining the gun ownership of those people who have received specific orders not to go near their family because they're a threat to them. The Republican Party, in the wake of CPAC, now with their plan to be the Republican Party 3.0. We will go over that plan, their autopsy, as they call it. Just a reminder, we perform autopsies on dead things. And the Steubenville rape case verdicts are handed down. And apparently, you know, we're supposed to feel sympathy for these rapists. And also on the program today, the History Channel comes out with their blockbuster, I guess, recounting of the Bible. I didn't see it, but apparently in the Bible, President Obama is the devil. I don't know. Who knew? We will get to that in a moment. But I want to start off today's program with actually a very touching story that I found via Digby. And it comes from the FCKHate.com site, which is a equal rights organization. It posted this letter on Facebook Friday morning. It is a letter from a father to a son. And it's apropos today, apparently. Well, I mean, it's always apropos, but the notion of marriage equality is very much in the news in a political sense. Coming out of CPAC, there really does seem to be some sense that even the Republican Party, at least on some level, is admitting that they no longer can get some type of electoral benefit out of the homophobia that has been one of their go-tos over the past decade, specifically the past decade in terms of electoral power. And Hillary Clinton, I guess, came out today in favor of marriage equality to the extent that that's relevant. I mean, it's better than her not, I guess. But really, the most important aspects of this is, while it's arguable that, you know, obviously it's incredibly important for all people to have the same rights in marriage, but it also has huge implications in terms of people's lives. I mean, that's what it's ultimately always been about. But this really brings it home, particularly with young people. We hopefully are past the point in the history of this country to some extent. I mean, we're obviously not fully there, but we're past the point where young people will grow up with an incredible amount of stigma and feelings of alienation and being alone and really living tortured childhoods because they are not able to express who they are in a very basic and real way. And this letter from a father to his son is just incredibly touching in that respect. Apparently, the father overheard a phone conversation between his son, who I can't tell if he's in high school or in college or what. His son planning to come out to his parents. And the father writes a letter. It's really so sweet. It's almost hard to read without choking up. But I overheard your phone conversation with Mike last night about your plans to come out to me. And the only thing I need you to plan is to bring home OJ and bread after class. We are out like you now. I've known you were gay since you were six. I've loved you since you were born. Dad. P.S. Your mom and I think that you and Mike make a cute couple. It's just so sweet and indicative of the implications of this for literally hundreds of thousands, millions perhaps, millions, of course, of children, that they're going to be able to grow up in a world that accepts them for who they are and don't need to hide from themselves or from their family. And so it's a very encouraging time in that respect, at least in this society. So I wanted to start off with a positive note today. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Matt Taibbi about the golden boys of the banking industry. It turns out they are, they're just as criminal as the rest of them. We'll be right back after this.
I'm looking through a pane of glass. Look through the
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to this program from a Rolling Stone magazine. He was live blogging, folks, last Friday. Let's welcome to the program Matt Taibbi. Welcome to the program, Matt.
What's going on, Sam?
Well, you know, same old, buddy. it turns out now, let's just take a step back here because it's amazing. I don't know what's more amazing, that we're seeing these hearings six years later, later than probably they should have been held, maybe decades later than they should have been held. But on Friday, the Senate Banking Subcommittee held a hearing where they invited executives of J.P. Morgan to come up and explain to them how it is they suffered billions of dollars of losses on these trades that theoretically should not have happened, or they should not have been able to, I guess, suffer
hide
such
it.
Losses,
yeah.
Hide it, and to allow it to continue, right? Now, so let's just back up. Just tell us, we've talked about this on this program in the past, obviously many times before, but put into context who J.P. Morgan and Jamie Dimon are in the context of this argument of too big to fail banks. Because as far as I can tell, I mean, I watched that movie, Too Big to Fail. Jamie Dimon, he was like, he was the one cool cucumber who really did everything right, as far as I can tell, right?
Yeah, that's sort of the urban legend about J.P. Morgan Chase, is that they're the quote-unquote good bank.
Mm-hmm.
And all these other banks that have bad reputations, you know, Goldman, commercial banks like Bank of America that everybody hates, those companies are screw-ups. If you do it right, you know, you can be like J.P. Morgan Chase and it's not a problem, and they're a safe, sound institution that makes a lot of money for America, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, that's the legend. The reason we're having hearings about this stuff is, and this is a big question that people don't understand, why are we having hearings about the fact that a private bank lost a ton of money last year? Like, we shouldn't care, right, theoretically. But we do, because J.P. Morgan Chase is a commercial bank, which means that it's a federally insured depository institution. So that if it goes under, the FDIC is going to have to bail out the bank, or as we found out in 2008, it'd be, you know, the whole government plus the Fed and a whole lot of other people would be bailing out the bank. So we have to care about it when they suddenly start acting like high-risk investment banks and lose tons of money and do it without the regulators having any clue what happened. And that's what happened last year. At the beginning of last year, this guy in London, he had basically this hedge fund hidden inside of J.P. Morgan Chase. And just sort of overnight, it started losing billions of dollars, and nobody knew about it until the news hit the newspapers. And that's what these hearings were about.
And part of the myth around Jamie Dimon and the myth about there being a good bank that is this big is that the implications are that it's not a systemic problem in the sense that too big to fail banks are problematic, but just that it's, you know, we have some bad actors. Like in any system, there are bad actors and there are good actors, and that doesn't
right.
implicate the system. But so that's why it seems to me has been so why it's been so crucial to maintain this myth of a good bank, because it supposedly says we don't really need any massive reforms. We don't really need to pull these banks apart in any way because it can be done properly. And it's quite clear that that's just a fantasy.
And you can't forget that the government itself endorsed this idea during the crisis, because when companies like Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch and Washington Mutual, when they all, you know, started circling the drain, what did we do? Instead of taking those companies over, selling them off, breaking them up into smaller banks, which is what rationally you probably would want to do, is to make the companies less dangerous. They just took these companies and they stuffed them into even bigger companies. So, you know, Bear Stearns gets pushed into J.P. Morgan Chase. Washington Mutual gets thrown into Wells Fargo. So the government itself bought this idea that it's not the size of the banks that's inherently the problem. It's that some of these companies are more screwed up and irresponsible than others. So we can fix the problem by putting bad banks into good banks. And it turns out that that's not the case. The size is inherently a problem.
And we should add that the one of the best examples of that notion that the size of the banks is problematic is that our Attorney General came out the other day and reiterated what we have heard now on several occasions, that you really can't hold these people to account for lawbreaking because they're too big. And
right.
if we put any of these guys in jail, then, you know, we're going to wreck the economy. So
right.
It's sort of the classic facts on the ground type of situation. We're going to make them even bigger. And then, you know, now they're there. There's nothing we can do about it.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, it's kind of an amazing combination of moves, right? Like first, let's create a bank that's gigantic like Chase by, you know, taking Bear Stearns and selling it to Chase at some absurdly low price. If you remember, the government actually slashed the price of Bear Stearns to $2 a share so that Chase could acquire it. And it's, you know, when it was last trading, it was at $30 a share or something. So they give these banks enormous public support and bailouts and discounts so that they can acquire these other companies. And then they turn around and they say, like a couple of years later, oh, we can't prosecute these guys because they're too big. So you have to look at the combination of moves and see how crazy it is.
And so you started your live blogging out with just a reminder that that Chase has paid $8 billion in settlements in just the past, well, I guess three and a half years. They've spent $16 billion in legal defense fees during that same
right.
period. I mean, it really is amazing. I mean, I used the analogy before you came on that, you know, it may not be fair to say that they're wholly a criminal enterprise, but I don't know what is. I mean, even when people go to rob a bank, presumably they pay attention to the speed limit on their way there.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, so, you know,
yeah,
they're driving with a car that has both taillights. You know, so they're not fully a criminal enterprise. But it's shocking. So let's walk through this because over the course, I mean, your assessment of the hearing, in my estimation, was that you were pretty impressed with the job that the senators did. And you see this hearing as pretty important at this point.
What I'm getting is that there's been this kind of change of heart in Washington, because I just keep hearing that different staffers working for different congressmen and different senators are coming around on this issue of too big to fail. There are both Republican and Democratic senators who are starting to kind of creep over across to the other side, away from the banks and onto the side of, Jesus, we got to do something about this. And it's just they're continually applying pressure, and the, you know, by taking on Chase head on, and Chase is supposed to be the good bank, and Chase is Obama's quote unquote favorite banker. That it was a significant thing that Carl Levin did. It's one thing to go after, some rogue company, but they went after the most reputable of the too big to fail banks, and they basically did an autopsy, a living autopsy of how the accounting at these companies works, and they showed everybody that there are zero internal controls at these companies, and that we have absolutely no idea what's going on, and that just exposed everybody to the danger that we're in. And I think even it's going to become both a conservative and a liberal issue, because neither the liberal view of it is going to be we don't want to have to support these evil corporations, but the conservative view is, why should my tax dollars go to support, this kind of activity? They should be sinking or swimming in the market. So I just think it's significant in the sense that there are more people moving over to that side.
Before we go and break down these hearings, what do you think accounts for that? I mean, what accounts for that? Because it seems to me that this information has been more or less out there. From my perspective, what do you think accounts for it? I mean, do you think it's simply because we're now outside of, in some ways, we're outside of a lot of the accounting that could have taken place within the statute of limitations for all the mortgage fraud? Do you think it's things like
That might be part of it. Yeah,
that documentary, The Untouchables, in some level seem to have
the frontline thing.
Yes,
but I think it's a bunch of things. Number one, I think Wall Street made a big mistake when they abandoned the Democrats in this election season, because what they traditionally do is smart. They just throw tons of money at both sides, and they don't really make a directional bet on politics. I mean, they usually bet according to the Las Vegas odds. In other words, if Obama's a 7-3 bet to win over John McCain, they're going to give Obama $7 and McCain $3. That's the way they've always operated. It has nothing to do with politics. It's just purely, we think this guy's going to win and that guy isn't. This time around, they didn't do that. Even though Obama was the heavy favorite, they really supported Romney in this election. And so a lot of Democrats were scratching their heads afterwards and saying, well, Jesus, we have been carrying water for these guys for years, and we've been helping them, and we watered down the Dodd-Frank Act, and we've done all this, we bailed them out, and then they cut and ran on us in the election season, so what are we doing? There's that. And then I think a major thing is that the people who work in the Fed and in the regulatory system are increasingly screaming bloody murder about all this stuff. I mean, there are, it's not just the Dallas Fed anymore. There was a New York Federal Reserve Bank official who gave a pretty big speech in the fall about how too big to fail is unsustainable. They asked all these companies to make up what they called living wills. In other words, a plan for what happens if your company goes out of business. And the Fed determined that these wills were complete fiction, that they didn't do a good job. And so everybody's worried. I think it just has to do with a general fear that these guys learned nothing after 2008. They're continuing to support themselves with massive amounts of free government money. And, when they blow up, we're going to have to go in and pay for all this again, and we don't have the money to do it. So it's just as simple as that. I think people are just worried.
And I wonder what the implications are of Levin retiring. I mean, I just look at what Ted Kaufman did when he had his 2 years
right.
as a sort of a temporary senator. He was Biden's chief of staff. He was basically took over Biden's seat, was appointed to Biden's seat, and he seemed to be the most aggressive senator in the Senate in going after this stuff. And, he had a 2-year window, and he didn't necessarily have the seniority to push these things through. I wonder if Levin feels that, you know, this is, I mean, because it's when I heard that he was going to retire, it's you know, one of two things, of course. One, he's going to go get a job at Citibank because that's what they do.
Right.
Or maybe he sees, like, maybe this is my legacy in some respects.
Well, I know that he's built, you know, he has this permanent subcommittee on investigations, and he's built a pretty impressive thing with that group. I mean, it's a small group of people. There's maybe 15 people in the staff, and they're like the high-end crew that investigates really hairy, complicated, you know, financial scandals. They did the KPMG investigation years ago. They've done a lot of money laundering stuff. They did the Goldman investigation. They did HSBC. Now they've taken on Chase. And so they're, you know, I think the legacy that Levin is leaving behind is he has built, you know, something within Congress that is taking up some of the responsibilities of the regulators that have stopped doing their jobs with all this stuff. I mean, these investigations shouldn't be being done by a Senate subcommittee. They should be being done by the OCC or the Fed or the SEC. And what he's really doing by commissioning these investigations is it's an implicit indictment of the regulators saying you guys are falling down on the job and we have to do it for you. And that's I think it's pretty cool. It's and the people that he's hired are pretty impressive people.
And we should say the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency,
right,
from basically
primary
the Treasury Department.
Banking yeah. regulator. Yeah.
All right. So let's just walk through this. Just remind people of exactly what the London whale trades were.
So basically, Chase has all this money. They have all these deposits, and they need to do something with this money to try to make, you know, more money. And one of the things that they did is they created this essentially a giant hedge fund within the company. It's called the Synthetic Credit Portfolio. And they have all these hotshot traders who are betting on things like credit default swaps and other derivative instruments. And what happened was these guys had been making a lot of money by betting on derivatives for years. Last year, I guess it was around December or January, they started to bet on corporate credit. I guess they were expecting a big bounce in corporate performance at the beginning of last year. But what happened was the market went the other way. I think also there's an interesting kind of sidebar here is that some people suspected that there were other traders who were consciously trying to squeeze Chase because they knew that they had created a very big long position that they had bet heavily in this one direction, and that everybody else hated them so much that they all went in the other direction to try to make them lose money. That doesn't matter. The important thing is they bet on corporate credit in January of last year. They started losing tons of money, and then instead of cutting their losses, they doubled down and they started losing even more money. And so what could have been a $400 or $500 million loss suddenly turned into, you know, $1.2 billion, $1.5 billion, and before they were done, it was like $6 billion. And this whole thing actually came out in the newspapers before the federal regulators knew about it. And it's even possible that some of it came out in the papers before the senior management of Chase knew about it, because they had been monkeying around with their accounting internally so much that they had lost track of how much money they were actually losing. So that's what these hearings were really all about: is how do these banks do their accounting, and how could it be possible that you could lose $6 billion and nobody can know about it.
And presumably, I mean, the way that this should be working is that they should be reporting these losses, I guess, primarily to the OCC and to the SEC insofar as how they represent the stability of their bank to shareholders.
And their quarterly reports, yeah.
And so what would have happened what would have happened if this had been done properly? I mean, in the way that the laws supposedly call for, in terms of they're reporting as they're going forward these losses to the OCC, and at one point the OCC says, hey, wait a second. You're now, because the U.S. government backstops your bank in about 14 different ways, you're just being too risky.
Well, first of all, the OCC didn't even know about the existence of this fund. It's not even mentioned in any documents until like January of 2012. So yeah, that's unbelievable, because by the time, at its very peak, this fund had a notional value of like $157 billion. Now, that's not to say that that's how much it was actually worth, but, you know, and if everything went completely wrong, that's roughly how much that's how much the liability was. So it's this gigantic, gigantic thing. And the primary banking regulator doesn't even know it exists. So that's an important thing. And they were not providing data about this fund to the OCC. What they were doing is they were lumping in the profits and losses of this fund in with other stuff, and then handing in kind of an aggregate number to the regulators. Now, at one point when they started to lose money, I think this was in January, Jamie Dimon orders his subordinates to just stop sending any data at all about this fund to the OCC, even though it was obligated legally to do that. So that was one thing that was incredible. That went on for about 2 weeks until the OCC forced them to start sending data again. The other thing is, when they started to lose money in the fund, instead of recognizing those losses, they just changed the way they measured how much money was in the fund. So, you know, you have all these derivative instruments, and it's a little bit of a subjective art to evaluating them. Traditionally, there was a very conservative way that people would value these securities or these instruments. Instead, they changed the way they did it to take the most optimistic view of how much these things were worth. And so that's a very typical thing that we've seen throughout this entire crisis period, is that whenever these banks get in trouble, they just sort of change their methodology of how they measure how much their assets are worth. So those are some of the issues that went on during this time. They hid the thing from the OCC. They stopped giving data when things started going wrong, and they changed their accounting methodology when things went wrong.
When they stopped giving data to the OCC, their argument is they're doing this because of they felt that their data wasn't safe with the OCC, and that there was
right.
Explain that justification. I mean, I just we should also not gloss over the fact that they just simply decided to no longer follow the law, because they just
right.
thought, like, it's bad for us. You can come up with any type of explanation, but there are procedures theoretically. It's not like, you know, Jamie Dimon doesn't have access to talk to the regulators in some fashion by saying, like, hey, we have a problem with this. They just decided, meh. We're just not going to get
it. It's amazing. And John McCain actually was the one who kind of went after them in the hearings about this. He's like, let me get this straight. You guys were concerned about confidentiality, so you just stopped following the law? And he's like, well, so, and, you know, we just were worried there were leaks, you know, and, you know, it's very important for us that this data be confidential. And the funny thing is the attitude that came out in the answer was that this made complete and total sense to this guy. I think his name is Doug Bronstein, who was the witness from Chase. It didn't sound like he was dissembling or trying to cover up. He thought he was giving a perfectly reasonable explanation. And McCain is sitting up there saying, you know, I think the rest of us in America, we don't think of ourselves as having the option of when we get to follow the law and when we don't. But apparently you do. And it was just a surreal moment in the hearings.
This is equivalent of getting pulled over by a cop for going 85 in a 55 mile an hour zone and going, officer, I was late.
Yeah, I was late, you know, I just wanted to see, you know,
my favorite TV show's on, and I don't have the ability to DVR it in my car, so can we just get this over with? And okay, and so the list of offenses that actually came up in this goes even beyond this, right? I mean, they their internal controls were. I mean, it's so hard to sort of get through this. It's whether or not there was a failure of their internal controls or whether they specifically said, like, let's set up our internal controls in such a way as that so that they're not so controlling and that they're a little bit more opaque. I mean,
no, that's exactly what happened. That's exactly the problem, which is they – you know, when they became aware of the problem, the senior executives at this company, they should have gone in and said, oh, my God, you morons, you can't just change your accounting, you know, procedures and hide losses that way. We're going to get killed for this. You know, they should have immediately, you know, thrown some of their lesser subordinates over the edge and forced them to take the rap. But that's they went in the other direction completely, and they just took the lie to another level. You know, they're holding a conference call for investors on April 13th after this has already come out, and they're basically saying, "Oh, don't worry about this. The OCC has been aware of this the entire time." I mean, they're lying to investors. They lied in their SEC disclosures. I mean, they knew how much the loss was back then, and they under-reported the losses in their SEC disclosure by about $600 million.
So this is where at one point Levin says that on April 13th, 2012, Chase had an internal report showing $1.2 billion in losses in this London Whale Fund, essentially. And mm-hmm. Ina Drew, she is the former CIO, the
head of risk or something like that. Yeah,
she's
chief investment officer. Okay. That's right. Yeah.
So she was privy to that report, but on the following Monday, she met with the OCC and just flat out lied, told her the losses were a little bit less than half of that.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, she said it was. She knew it was $1.2 billion, and she told them it was $719 million.
And in the hearing, she says the reason why she lied, or why she did that, is she says because the OCC, as far as I knew, had been given daily profit and loss reports. So I guess what's unsaid there is that they should have known that I was lying, or should have stepped up and said, hey, wait a second, don't you mean $1.2 billion instead of $580 million? And she would have gone, oh, yeah.
right, exactly. So she basically says, we've been sending you the daily numbers, which we also find out in this hearing that they haven't been, right? You know, that's one of the things that came out is that the OCC actually wasn't getting those daily numbers. But she's saying they should have been able to figure it out because we were sending them the raw data. So it didn't matter that I lied to the primary banking regulator of the United States in, you know, what was last year the biggest banking disaster in the world. It doesn't. That's not material. It's not nothing to worry about because it's the government's fault for not figuring out themselves. Now, so that just gives you some insight into the thinking of these people. You know, it's.
But she's also simultaneously claiming that she didn't know that they weren't sending this data to the OCC. Right. I mean, so basically what we're seeing here bit by bit is how these officials have created firewalls from themselves in terms of accountability. I lied here, but I did that based upon the knowledge that you had the data to know that I was lying. What I didn't know was that you didn't have the data to know that I was lying. So I'm not really responsible because I lied in good faith in thinking that you knew that I was lying.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Or something, right? I mean, or I just lied. I mean, I don't know. It's so crazy. But, yeah, you're right. What comes out in these hearings is that it's never anybody's fault. It's always, you know, I did this based on the information that I had at the time. But – you know what? The bottom line in all of this is that they did know, and they just lied to everybody. They lied to the SEC. They lied to the OCC. They lied to the investing public, and they lied to Congress. Because remember, you know, Jamie Dimon himself had to go to Congress and answer questions about all of this last year, and you know, a lot of the things that, you know, the versions that he gave in that hearing did not quite square with what the committee found in its investigation. So, but, and even taking all that into consideration, nothing's going to happen. And that's what's so infuriating about this.
Now, didn't she also, Ina Drew, she also sort of ultimately said, I got lied to about what the losses were by two guys, a Macris and a Martin Artejo, I guess.
Right.
Who coincidentally are not subject to U.S. jurisdiction, so they can't be here today, essentially, right? I mean, is that
right?
I mean, this...
right. Yeah, there were a whole bunch of people, and this is actually, there's a big notation, a kind of an ominous notation at the beginning of the Levin report, which is that X, Y, A, B, C, and D official did not make themselves available to be interviewed for this report, including Ixil and Artejo and all these other people who are in London, or I'm not exactly sure where they are, but they're outside the jurisdiction of these regulators. And so, yeah, it's not an accident. I mean, that's, you know, there's this whole concept of regulatory arbitrage that you have on Wall Street now, which is you go and you find the location where the laws are the weakest, and that's where you put your headquarters for your operations. And that's why there's so many of these high risk trading funds are based in London, because the regulations there are weaker than ours, especially in terms of derivative trades. That's right. You're exactly right.
It's stunning. I mean, I pulled one of these things. I mean, hopefully my father's not listening to the program right now. But when I was in high school, there was, you know, I had a party when my father was away one time.
Mm-hmm.
And he apparently found some contraband that was left after the party. And He confronted me with it, and I said it must have been that guy, Jimmy Sullivan, who came over with my friends, who I don't know very well at all. He's friends with these other friends, and I am so mad at that Jimmy Sullivan. I'm never going to talk to that guy again. As far as I'm concerned, he's dead to me. Which was easy to do because he never existed. I mean, that's
right.
More or less what we're seeing here, right? And so what?
Yeah, totally.
So now, I know that my father did not have the ability to track down Jimmy Sullivan because that guy dropped out of school shortly after that incident and moved to North Carolina, as far as I can recall. But what happens next? I mean, so you've got this permanent Senate subcommittee that is investigating these crimes. And what happens next? Does this just go into the ether, and does Carl Levin then, you know, cut out something from Dear Abby and you know, leaves it on Jamie Dimon's book bag in the morning and say, don't become a statistic when it comes or what happens at this point?
Well, what should happen and what I think probably will happen is that one of the regulators will take up the case and they will craft a settlement out of it. If you remember when Levin took on Goldman, among others, actually he in that whole report that he did on Goldman Sachs also included a lot of information about Washington Mutual and Deutsche Bank. But after that, the SEC took the results of that investigation, and they used it as the basis of a civil prosecution against Goldman, where they got $550 million, which is like a 1/24th of what they got from the AIG bailout. But that doesn't matter anyway. The point is, typically, what happens when somebody like this committee does really good investigative work, some other regulator will take it and run with it. I would guess that there are lots of different possibilities here. The Department of Justice could take it up. The SEC could take it up because there's a whole section in there about them lying in their 10Q disclosures about these trades. There's, there are accounting irregularities where they could be prosecuted by the DOJ. So there's a lot of stuff that can go on. Yeah,
I imagine we'll see a lot of private action too, right? I mean, because if they have
but here's the problem: is that a lot of these settlements, when they settle, and this is what happened with HSBC. Well, I forget what happened with HSBC, but usually, typically, when they settle, they say, "We're settling. We're going to give the government money, but we neither admit nor deny wrongdoing," which doesn't allow people who are suing privately to automatically win. So sometimes these settlements that come afterwards actually help the company because they make it harder for civil courts to make determinations of guilt or innocence when the regulators themselves didn't insist upon that. So that's a danger here. Obviously, a lot of people are going to want to sue. Anybody who lost money, making these trades, or everybody who was on the other side of those trades, they might want to sue, but, we'll just have to see what happens in terms of which regulators pick up the ball from here.
And then there's a sort of the larger transcendent narrative that this is one more example. Or really, I mean, it seems to me it's even larger than that, because this is supposedly the good apple in the bunch, right? And if we realize the good apple in the bunch is also rotten to the core, then we and I'm really using the not the royal we here. I'm actually using sort of maybe more society or our government, and it needs to recognize that too big to fail is simply. It adds fuel to that fire that too big to fail is not sustainable.
Definitely. And there's, Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, is trying to revive this Brown-Kaufman amendment that he was pushing a couple of years ago that would place caps on the size of these companies.
And he's doing it with Vitter too. Is that right? I mean,
exactly. That's what I'm talking about. It's like they're, we just keep getting these little defections, into this camp. It's not Sherrod Brown and Ted Kaufman anymore. It's Sherrod Brown and David Vitter. And this time it's not just Carl Levin. It's Carl Levin and John McCain. It's so, and we have Elizabeth Warren now, and So there's, I think that there's momentum to do something about this issue. It's just, it's going to take, you know, probably one more big disaster. But the ducks are kind of lined up right now for people to do something, because now that everybody can see how badly these companies are run and how impossible it is to trust their accounting, I can't imagine that Congress and the FDIC and the Fed and all these different institutions are really going to want to be on the hook for backstopping these companies anymore.
Are you aware? I mean, I imagine there must be, and maybe to a certain extent it's there in the legislation that Brown is pushing with Vitter. But good sort of conceptual roadmaps, or even maybe even more specific than conceptual roadmaps of just how you would divvy up these banks. I mean, you know, presumably, you know, this seems to me is the time where these type of plans must be in existence, because if we do have to wait for the next disaster, as it were, there needs to be solutions that are at hand, so that the momentum built by that next disaster can be harnessed, and you can put a plan in place to begin to pull these banks apart.
Well, the Brown plan is a great plan, because it's incredibly simple. It just says you can't be numerically bigger than this amount. You can't have more than 10% of the nation's deposits, and you can't have more than this percentage of, you know, of the investment banking market. And so as soon as you go over that size, they force you to sell off divisions within the company. But, you know, in talking to people about this issue, I think the more likely route that we're going to see is we're going to have some kind of like Justice Department prosecution or a regulatory settlement involving one of these companies, or maybe a couple of them. And as a condition of the settlement, they're going to force them to break up. That's a much simpler way of affecting this change, and it's not going to require congressional approval. It's just going to be a thing that happens. And since there's only five or six of these companies, you know, I mean, it's not a big number. I think that there could be, you know, for instance, something like Elliott Spitzer's global settlement from the early 2000s, when he took all of them and basically got all the banks in the room and said, look, you know, I could take all your money for all the stuff that you guys have been doing, but instead I'm going to insist that you stop doing business this way. I think that's the kind of thing that could happen. It could just be a thing where a prosecutor says, let's get all these guys in the room and say, you all have been committing the same accounting violations. You've all been lying to us in the same way. And so now, instead of taking all of your money, which I could do because you've all broken the law, or throwing you all in jail, you're all going to get smaller, or we're going to put you out of business. I think that's the much more likely route that this is going to go.
Because then you also avoid the sort of the political implications of legislation that, you know, we have in some way nationalized or interfered with the free market at that point, right? I mean, then it becomes more just a policing action.
Exactly, which is, you know, weirdly enough, that's the way it should be. I mean, I guess you would like there to be some kind of precedent saying that you can't, you know, be so big that, you know, we can't prosecute you if you commit a crime. It would be great if there was some kind of law that said that. But the reality is that the problem, this is really a criminal justice problem. Right. It's just that these companies are so big that they become unmanageable and ungovernable. So we should govern them. You know, we should just have the regulators say, look, this has gotten that out of our control. You guys have to just get smaller. That's what we're going to do instead of taking all your money this time.
And presumably, once one or two banks are pulled apart, there becomes the political pressure becomes more there becomes more of an equilibrium in terms of the political pressure, right? Because these banks don't want to compete against these other too big to fail banks.
Right, right. And also, I would imagine once that starts happening, the share prices of the other companies are going to start to wobble a little bit because the market's going to be uncertain about their future. You know, if you were to have that kind of an action, but this is all, you know, speculation. It's all far in the future. But what's interesting to me is that I think there's just momentum toward that now. You know, this kind of stuff is not going away. It's not just we're reacting to MF Global or we're reacting to the crash of 2008. It's like, we're going to continue investigating you, and every time we do it, we just keep finding worse and worse stuff, and that's the headline for all this, and so that's what's so interesting.
Well, I can't wait until my newborn child has the opportunity to have you back on the program to talk about when.
You have a newborn child?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes, my son was born a couple of a week and a half ago or so.
Wow.
And
wow.
I'm training him feverishly with the hopes that this happens sooner rather than later, so that you can come on and tell us about that happening. But in the meantime, maybe just you and I, as we recount our march towards that. Matt Taibbi, Rolling Stone magazine, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sam.
Talk to you later. Soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break in a moment and head to the better half of the program, where you can call this program at 646-257-3920. Couple of words. Now, I don't want Michael or Matt to feel badly about this. I mean, let's be honest, I do. We have one person who is in charge of doing membership who asked me, is our system broken? Because all of last week we didn't have a single new member. Now, we had some of you cancel, obviously, because financial hardship and whatnot. But so, folks, surely some of you are sitting out there who listen to the program on a daily basis, twice daily, thrice daily, twice weekly. So maybe it's twice daily, twice weekly, thrice weekly. Surely for you, this program is worth the 33 cents a day. I did some computations. Like, the lowest package I think you can get with cable, at least in New York, is somewhere around like $100 a month. Is that right, Matt?
That is correct.
You're on the wrong mic. Remember your mic switched?
Oh, I switched my mic. Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is correct.
$100 a month. So at the most, membership to this program, support of this program, is 10% of what you pay for cable. If you're listening to this program 2-3 times a week, ask yourself, am I actually in watching cable 10 times more than I am listening to the Majority Report? If the answer is no, maybe it's time for you to look yourself in the mirror and say, why don't I just listen to this program 5 times a week and get rid of cable? Just go to internet. Or, for that matter, if I can afford it, I will support both. So, if you can, folks, please support the program by becoming a member today at majority.fm. We are dangerously close to having an app. I mean, dangerously close. It could come any day now. And you don't want to miss out on that, ladies and gentlemen. So become a member.
Would have been sooner if we had some more members.
It's true. It's true. You can't. Apps don't grow on trees.
And by the way, I view it as a gigantic victory that email said this is the system down, and not did you close up shop last week because everyone just left in droves.
That's true.
I think it's great that people.
Now, come on, don't get sensitive. I'm just don't get sensitive, guys. Don't get sensitive.
I thought we did an all right job.
No, you did a good job.
I was thinking specifically, we always remembered it. We mentioned the kid endlessly.
Right.
Maybe we overdid the kid.
Maybe it's that kid. Maybe it's that listeners just don't care about your kid.
Well, that's right. Okay. Well, we'll see. I mean, if you want my newborn child to be able to interview Matt Taibbi in
Remember that really that odd message you got a couple of months ago when you announced the baby? And some guy was like, I was going to become a member, but you're having a kid. So
yeah, obviously.
maybe that's the problem.
Right. That could be the problem. All right. So, folks, you can become a member, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. 10% discount coupon code majority. If you buy crap through Amazon, buy it through our link. You can find it at majority.fm/support-the-show. Buy it through our link. You will not notice a difference. You can just bookmark that link. Keep buying your Amazon crap through it. You will not notice a difference, but we will get a little kickback. It is so simple, so easy. And, of course, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Tweet our tweets at donateyouraccount.com.
Retweet our tweets, buddy.
Tweet our tweets. Retweet our tweets. I was on Up with Chris this past weekend, the second to final weekend with Up with Chris Hayes. Pretty soon it's going to be Up with somebody else. But I can tell you this for sure, it's not going to be Up with Sam. But it was a pretty good talk. Maybe for members, next week we'll include that. We will include that audio. It was pretty good. It was an interesting breakdown of, well, we'll talk more about it in the better half of the program. And that's it. Let's take a break. Tomorrow on the program, we will have Becky Bond from Credo Action talking about some of the things that Credo is doing and pushing for. And their role, we meant to have her on 2 weeks ago, but my kid got in the way of this. I mean, I'm not going to hold it over him for too long, but we're going to talk about Credo's role in that Illinois race, the Democratic primary to replace Jesse Jackson Jr., because we've heard a lot about what Bloomberg's money bought. And money can buy you a lot of things, but yeah, so can a direct action and so-called boots on the ground. And Credo had a big hand in that. So we will talk to them, and I'm 97% sure we're going to announce that they're going to be a sponsor of the program for the next couple of months. So either way, it was something I wanted to talk to Becky about, and this was a good excuse for me to pitch them coming back on the show to be a sponsor.
As long as there's not another birth of a baby tomorrow and you have to cancel it again.
Indeed. Indeed. All right, folks.
I don't know.
Stealth baby.
Yeah. I mean, that would be a very awkward pregnancy.
Here's a little encore.
Yeah, exactly. 2 weeks later. It would really question the quality of the doctor who did the delivery. We didn't realize he had another one in there. All right, folks. See you in the better half. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM. See you in a moment.